Oh, Russian fairies. I wasn't even thinking about them. All right. Welcome to the show. We're going to talk about fairies today. It could be argued that a host who wasn't Irish-American maybe wouldn't have done this show. I certainly come from a very fairy-friendly culture. One day when my father had what, in retrospect, I think was probably a transient ischemia attack, he, as he recovered, tried to allay our fears by saying, "I was influenced by elves." He talked about little people a lot. He didn't really believe in them, but I'm sure he grew up among members of the Irish diaspora who believe in them. When my friend Ann Batterson was traveling in Ireland, she stayed in an Irish guest house, and I don't know how the subject came up, but this is maybe in the 1980s or so. I don't know how the subject came up, but she said, "Do you believe in the little people?" And the woman who owned the house said, "No, but they're here," which is a very, very standard, I think, unsurprising Irish dualistic attitude about fairies. We think about fairies as living and being talked about and believed in the past, but they're also believed in now. I mean, within the last few years in Ireland, there was a lawmaker who believed that problems on the N22, a fairly major road in Ireland, were due to fairy activity and that they were going through areas that were rife with fairies. And in Iceland, they right around the same time, they were having a debate about whether to build a road through a rocky area that was known to be infested with fairies. And obviously there's a Wiccan revival going on in this country. Not all Wiccans believe in fairies, but there's a subset of Wiccans who absolutely are very interested in fairies. And then there's you. Sometime in your life, you or your offspring have sat in a theater and clapped your hands as hard as you could to show that you believe in fairies so that Tinkerbell might live again. So don't tell me you don't believe in fairies. We're going to do this show today partly because Midsummer Night's Dream is being played at Hartford Stage Company. We'll tell you about that in our second segment. In our final segment, we'll tell you about one of the most famous fairy cases in England. It happens to be 100 years old this year and involves the photographing of fairies, or maybe not. But first of all, we have to just sort of do a little basic fairyology, if there is such a thing. So joining us to do that right now is Richard Green, professor of English emeritus at Ohio State University, specializing in Middle English literature and author of the book Elf Queens and Holy Friars, Fairy Beliefs and the Medieval Church. Also joining us is, I hope I'm going to say this right, A. Ruth Bottigheimer, literary scholar, folklorist, and research professor at Stony Brook University, specializing in European fairy tales and children's literature. She's the author of Fairy Tales, A New History. Richard Green, welcome to the show. I want to begin with you. And if there's an answer, a general answer to the question, what are fairies supposed to be? I know there's no kind of equivalent of Olson's Book of Standard British Birds that covers fairies, but what can we say about them?
Well, I think we can easily get trapped in a kind of taxonomy of fairies. For me, it's better to look at them functionally, as it were. People believed in three kinds of humanoid spirits, creatures in the Middle Ages. There were solitary ones. They lived all alone in the forests, and you might come across them. There were household ones who lived amongst you and made the cream turn sour or did the dishes for you. But the ones I'm interested in are the ones who were social, who lived in a community in the outside, on the edge of the human life world, and interacted from time to time with the human beings, but had their own society, their own culture, which mirrored ours. I mean, and those were generally in the Middle Ages in England called elves. In France, they were called fays. But there are lots of other words for them too, terms for them too. And I think you can easily get caught up in trying to define what all these various words mean and what they apply to. I think this is the way a literate society thinks about things, a society with dictionaries. I don't think that's the way people in the Middle Ages, who were largely, or the society was largely oral, I don't think that's the way they thought about fairies. You know, the terms would vary from one village to another, I'm quite sure.
Maybe let's add Ruth to this conversation. First of all, I hope I did say your name correctly.
You did. You got it just right.
So in the Middle Ages, if people are believing in fairies, the Middle Ages are also a time of pretty intense Christian activity. Were those two things completely inharmonious with one another? What would fairies be? Heresy? Blasphemy?
Well, Professor Green is talking about belief in fairies and fairies as people experience, and my work is mainly with fairies in their literary history. And there's a pretty clear genealogy from medieval literature right down to the beginning of the 19th century. As far as the church is concerned, fairies were always regarded as competition for the legitimate sources of supernatural help, which in the church was called miracles. And so they were quite naturally pushed aside in favor of saints and the Virgin Mary.
Richard, were there ways, I mean, Christianity is notoriously syncretistic in terms of it referring to its ability to absorb some latent indigenous folk tradition or religious tradition. Could Christianity do anything with fairies?
Yeah, it did. It did. Perhaps the most obvious example, I think, is purgatory. The whole doctrine of purgatory, which it's been argued really only arose, it has forerunners, but it only arose in the 12th century. The whole doctrine of purgatory, if you look at it at least in the popular vernacular texts as opposed to Latin theological texts, is full of fairy lore. It's full of echoes of fairyland, and it seems to me that one way in which purgatory functioned culturally in medieval society was as a way of distracting people from their belief in fairies. That purgatory was the official sort of in between life and death state, whereas a lot of people believe that you could, like King Arthur, go off and live in fairyland, and that the church wasn't having, that the church couldn't accept, of course.
No.
But that's one example, but there are others. Yeah.
And Ruth, I think we need to talk about why fairy stories exist, maybe in a sort of Bettelheim sense. Why do we need to have fairy stories? What do they do as literature, as things that we tell to one another?
Well, let's start several hundred years before Bettelheim, because Bettelheim is very, very 19th century in his thinking. Let's start instead in the 12th century, when we get the first appearances of creatures called fairies, and they are pretty generally acknowledged to be sort of reformulations of the fates, of the three fates in particular. And these fairies are equally amoral. And the fairyland that Professor Green referred to is this parallel world where these fairies, unlike the fates, have a complete backstory. They've got friends, enemies, jealousies, loves. And very often, what's going on in their lives in fairyland has an effect on the humans who wander into their circle, into their parallel world. Now, that fairyland group of fairies persists right through the end of the Middle Ages and into the early modern period, into the age of print, when romances became tremendously popular. I'm talking about the late 1400s, early 1500s. And these romances had knights going off on quests and the rest, and they met up with giants and with fairies. And the literary part continues when fairy tales, as we know them in the modern world, fairy tales evolved very soon after that, and they were at bottom abbreviated romances, very abbreviated. And they had fairies in them who brought magic into the lives of people who were trying to make their lives better.
Right. There's something very appealing about the notion that fairies can grant wishes, that fairies can bestow magic on you, right, Ruth? Particularly if you're stuck in some little nowhere town in the Middle Ages, it doesn't seem like your life is going to change very much based on observable phenomena. But maybe unobservable phenomena are going to help you out.
Let's stop right there, because one thing that's running through this discussion is the people, and as though the people were something that everybody was. And there are very distinct populations in the Middle Ages. There are people who are educated, who might not be able to read necessarily, but they're educated because they've been exposed to literature which has either been read aloud or they've heard about. And then there are people who live very far from the world of letters, and those are the people who believe in imps and boggles and will-o'-the-wisps.
Richard, in a way we're sort of talking about two things. Literature exists for one set of reasons, and it's often because these are stories that we want to consume, maybe for some of the reasons that Ruth has been talking about. But fairies, as an idea, also exist, I think, because the notion that there are places where the veil is thin between one world and another, that there's an unseen world, that there's a world that we need to think about, even though we can't see it. I don't know. Can you help me a little bit, Richard,
yeah,
with that idea?
I think that's absolutely true. I do disagree a little with Ruth here. That I don't think the I think the division is largely between the educated, the literate, and the less literate and non-literate. There's evidence in the Middle Ages of people from the highest ranks of society showing an interest in fairies. So that I don't think that. It's a little too simple to say that the folk are just the peasantry. Having said that, I do think that there are all sorts of ways in which fairies have a cultural function at a village level. As you say, they provide a kind of spiritual realm which people can immediately grasp in a way that the church's rather rarefied religious ideas are much more difficult, I think, to accept. But they also allow people. They explain, and Ruth is very good on this. They explain things that in a pre-scientific society. That otherwise are difficult to explain, but they also, I think, can reconcile people to one another. The example I might give is fairies in the Middle Ages could have sex with mortals. That's very common in romances and in stories that turn up in chronicles too. And they could actually father children or they could bear children. When one thinks about it, this is actually a very good way at a village level, for accounting for otherwise unattributable pregnancies. If somebody has slept with a village priest, for instance, or slept with a married man and gets pregnant, a fairy paternity is a way for the villagers to kind of accept this and get on with life. So I think there's certainly an explanatory function, but I think there's also a way in which fairies kind of just oil the machinery of day-to-day existence. That's the benevolent side of them, of course. As Ruth points out, they can also be malevolent. But does that help?
I think that's helpful. We're going to have to wrap up this segment here. You've both been marvelous. Although one thing I will also say, Richard, here at the end is, and having just returned from Sligo and climbed Knock Nuree, where you have to work pretty hard not to believe in fairies and Carrowmore and all these megalithic ruins are around, you know, Yeats got interested in fairies and folktales and theosophy and all this stuff right around the time he got interested in Irish nationalism. And I do feel as though there's, maybe I'm stretching a point here, but I feel as though there's this notion that fairies are part of a local culture in a lot of places, and people may want to cling to those stories because they are, in this case, identifiably Irish as opposed to identifiably British or you know, it's a resistance to colonization, maybe.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think if you've been to Iceland for your holidays, you'd experience the same phenomenon. I think that there is a pride in local traditions and a resistance to outsiders telling you that they are nonsense. It's surprising how, you know, even the sort of Irish diaspora in North America still, as you pointed out at the top of the show, still clings to these beliefs, or if not. In some cases, genuinely, I think there are still people in the modern world who believe in fairies.
Absolutely, absolutely. We have to stop there. You both have been marvelous once again. It has been A. Ruth Bottigheimer. She's the author of Fairy Tales, A New History. A. Richard Green. The original initials aren't A. They're just in the A side. Richard Green, who's the author of Elf Queens and Holy Friars, Fairy Beliefs and the Medieval Church. We'll be back to talk about some fairies who are hanging around in Hartford right now.
Waiting on the next best thing. Next best thing, yeah. Once upon a time in a faraway kingdom, man made up a story, said that I should believe him. Go and tell your wife not that he's...
All right, we are back. We're talking about fairies. You know, sometimes people tell me, apropos of something like Game of Thrones, oh, I don't like fantasy. I don't do fantasy. And I always say to them, so no Tempest, no Midsummer Night's Dream. For that matter, in Romeo and Juliet, you've got Mercutio's great Queen Mab speech. Shakespeare was not unfond of fairies, and there are certain plays that require them. And, of course, Midsummer Night's Dream is one of them. It's being done at the Hartford Stage Company right now through October 8th. You still have time to go get tickets. We're going to talk to two participants in that show right now. But maybe just to get you in the mood, let's hear a little bit of Puck. We have a little clip from the show.
If we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is amended, that you have but slumbered here while these visions did appear, and this weak and idle theme, no more yielding, but a dream. Gentles, do not reprehend. If you pardon, we will mend. And, as I am an honest Puck, if we have unearned luck now to scape the serpent's tongue, we will make amends ere long. Else the Puck a liar call. So, good night unto you all.
We have the man who's speaking those words, Will Apicella, with us today. Also, Darko Treznik, the artistic director of Hartford Stage Company and the director of this show. Darko, I'm going to start with you. Welcome back to our show. And
thanks.
So, if you're going to direct Midsummer Night's Dream, you're going to have to make a decision about fairies. Who are they? What are they? What are they going to be within the reality of this show? So how did you think that through?
It's interesting because there are four worlds in Midsummer, and the first time I directed 11 years ago, I felt like I felt really pleased with the other three worlds, but not so much with the fairies, with what I did. So since then, I think what's different is I went to, you know, worked at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I've stayed in those woods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I walked at night and in the morning and at dusk, you know, the woods where Shakespeare grew up. And you realize that the phrase, like, I know a bank where the wild thyme blows, where ox lips and the nodding violet grows, quite over-canopied with luscious woodbine, with musk roses, or with eglantine. You think about it as an abstraction, but I was looking at the foliage, and I was like, oh, there it is, the language from Midsummer in front of me. So it was very much based on that. And then this summer, I went to Scotland, to the Isle of Skye, and we went to this place, the Fairy Glen. And I was like, oh, my God, this is what Shakespeare was writing about. So while I myself don't believe in fairies, I could see how the landscape inspired that. And what I've thought about, you know, in particular with Puck, is, you know, the way that he speaks, up and down, it's very much like the witches, double, toil and trouble, you know, that there's the sing-song pattern. It's like the witches in Macbeth. So, you know, what I've thought about is that this world of the fairies, that it's mercurial,
mm-hmm.
that they're capable of menace, that Puck in particular, I was looking for somebody because he really enjoys messing with those four young teenagers who are in love, you know. So very much those were the things that were on my mind, that I thought it should have a certain degree of menace, but also physically I wanted to be inspired by that landscape. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It does answer
mm-hmm.
my question.
Yeah.
Well, so Will,
yeah.
there are certain roles that you can prepare for if you're going to play a steel worker. I guess you can go to a steel yard or a construction
yeah.
site. How do you prepare to be Puck?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think for Puck, because like Darko was just saying, he speaks in a very specific, particular way, and the language is very, very intricate. So for me, it was all about just like taking a fine-tooth comb and going through all of the language and becoming for myself very, very clear about what it was I was saying, why I was saying it, why I was saying it in that specific manner, because he says things in very, like, you just heard that if we shadows have offended, think but this, but all is mended. It's in rhyming couplets. It's very, for the most part, it's very neat and very sort of neat, 10 syllables to a line.
Mm.
So for me, it was 2 weeks of just going through it, and then we got to rehearsals, and it was so interesting because so much of what Puck does is to the audience and in response to something he gets from the audience. But in rehearsal, obviously, you don't have an audience, so you're sort of assuming maybe what the response could be, what might it be, I'm not really sure. And then I didn't think I had anything truly in the direction of figuring something out with Puck until we had the first preview, when suddenly I had this response coming back from the audience. I was like, oh, that's what that means. That's why I'm behaving. That's why this is the, oh, that makes so much sense. And it was all because of the way I was interacting with the audience, which is perhaps more so than something that interacts with the audience a little less.
You know, Darko, as he says that, it strikes me that fairies in some ways are the early postmodernists. It's not just Puck interacting with the audience, which, as Will says, he does. But as I was mentioning earlier in the the stage version of Peter Pan, children are invited to clap their hands in the audience to save the life of Tinkerbell. The audience is actually told that it can affect what's happening on stage. Yeah. So, Darko, what do you make of that? Is that sort of the another version of the veil between one world and another?
I think, you know, I didn't hear the first part of your show. I just raced into the office. But I think in Shakespeare plays, you know, the actors always meet. The other acting partner is always the audience. And Shakespeare's characters know that somebody is watching. You know, it's foreign to some contemporary writers, and especially, strangely enough, to some contemporary critics who should know better. But, you know, the direct address in Shakespeare is a huge thing. In Midsummer, you know, Helen is the first one who breaks that wall and talks directly to the audience. So there is a great, great interest in doing that. And so when you have something like A Midsummer Night's Dream, it pulls you when they address you into that world of magic. It sucks you right in so that you open up your imagination to the possibility of supernatural.
You know, Darko, the first part of our show, I'm talking a little bit more to kind of ethnologists in general about the notion of fairies and how real they might have been at any given time. How real do you think fairies were to either Shakespeare or the audience at the Globe?
How real they were to them?
Yeah.
I think they believed in them. I'd like to think that Shakespeare believed in them. As I said, this was the trickiest part of the play for me because my mind doesn't go in that direction, you know. So at times I found myself struggling with this part of the play. And then I ask myself, I mean, when you meet Oberon and Titania, you know, in the beginning, I kind of finally I was like, okay, so the fairy king and queen are in the middle of a custody battle over a changeling child. They're slinging insults about infidelity. You know, everyone is running for cover. So I had to really kind of go to something very practical to give the actors, you know. And then on top of that, there is this extraordinary language and there, you know, and then there we find out that the discord between Oberon and Titania, that it's affecting the entire nature, you know, and she goes on to describe this ecological disaster that's very much like what has been happening in the world right now.
Yes,
and she says, and actually prophetically, she says, if we were to treat each other better, you know what I mean, this would go away. And it's just throughout the play, there's this extraordinary respect for nature. You know, that sort of struck me as prophetic. So going back to your question, I feel like, you know, for Shakespeare, when he writes about fairies and how they solve the discord in the fairy world, it has something, it's like a plea to humanity, plea to human beings with power to be better to each other, to nature, to everything that surrounds them. And so I find that, you know, that I think the supernatural life was useful to Shakespeare, that it was kind of, at least in Midsummer, a plea for kind of a better world. That's how I see it.
Well, we're almost out of time, but one thing we do know is that the word Puck, the name Puck, wouldn't have been necessarily unfamiliar. Puck, a.k.a. a Robin Goodfellow. Puck was a name they would have known, right?
Sure.
Yes. And the other thing, I'm not sure if you covered this earlier in the show, but there are references to Elizabeth in the play, and you know, she was associated with fairies, you know, that she was powerful, supernatural. And when Oberon talks about the imperial votress, pass it on, and maiden meditation, fancy free, that's a direct reference to Elizabeth in the play. So I think you know, humanizing of the rulers,
yes,
you know, using fairies as a metaphor has a lot to do with it.
So, Darko, I've got about a minute left. Let me go over to Will for a second. So,
please.
Will, when you're out there, do you feel like a fairy? I mean, are you trying to feel like something other than a human being?
Yeah, I think so. Because Puck can shapeshift into thousands of different things. Anything I'd like to shapeshift into, I can. And while I keep what is my form during the play, I feel like very sort of fluid, and I'm trying to create this aura of hopefully the audience believes with the snap of my fingers I could be a headless bear or a hound or a hog, and I have the power to conjure up all of this fog and mist and lead people around and become invisible. So, I mean, I never 100% think, oh yeah, I'm a fairy right now, I can do all these things, but I think when you really commit to the language of what he's saying and all the things I say that I can do, eventually it sort of engenders some sort of movement in you where you think, wow, maybe I could do this.
All right.
I do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and hopefully the audience thinks that too. But we have to stop there. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back in a little while. We're going to tell you about one of the most heated discussions of fairies that the semi-modern world has ever known. It was 100 years ago in a British village. Meanwhile, some people are going to come on and tell you reasons why you should support this station. If you like our show in particular, and if you like the idea that there is a show that might do an entire show episode about fairies in the year 2017, perhaps you'll contribute now. It kind of gets marked down on our ledger in an especially nice way. So please do. Ordinarily in this space, Kyone Wolf comes on and tells you who did what. She's not here today, so I will do it. Josh Nalea is the producer of this show. This is one of these shows that I really wanted to do, and so I made somebody do it. But he has risen to the challenge here and done a show about fairies. Betsy Kaplan's on the board today. Jonathan McNichol is running around helping out with this thing and that thing. Amanda Fish actually is a fairy, and of course the part of Bill Curry was played by Arthur Conan Doyle. Tomorrow, let me tell you what's happening tomorrow. Tomorrow, I'm going to be on the Wheelhouse in the morning talking about politics at 9. Then we are going to rerun at 1 a show that, if you haven't heard, I really urge you to listen to. It's about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It's a pretty deep analysis into the music, but I mean, a really fun deep analysis that we did a while back with Steve Metcalf and one other guest who'd made a documentary about it. And then I will be, the reason I'm doing that is that at night at 7 p.m. at Watkinson School, I will be hosting one of those forums known as Freshly Squeezed. It's called the Great Democracy Suggestion Box. The notion is, if you feel as though our democracy is broken right now, how would you go about fixing it? What would be a thing that you could do, maybe a structural change that you could make, a philosophical change that you could make that would get at the roots of our democracy and water them better than they're being watered now? Bill Curry, former counselor to President Bill Clinton, will be a panelist. So will Bilal Siku, a professor of political science at the University of Hartford, and Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Policy Institute, upholding the conservative end of things. And I think there may be some tickets still available. You go to watkinson.org to find out about that and look around for the Freshly Squeezed icon or whatever there is there. All right, that's all I have to say in terms of new business. Now it's time to talk about something that is having its 100th anniversary this year, which means that in 1917, there was, in a very small town, as I understand it anyway, a very small town called Cottingley in Britain, a report of fairies. And it's been talked about a lot, chronicled in lots of different ways. And I've actually seen the movie that is based on it called Photographing Fairies. Why don't we just, before we even get going here, play a clip from that movie. You're going to hear Edward Gardner, a leading member of England's Theosophical Society, addressing a meeting of said society about these photographs said to be of fairies.
A waterfall near the village of Cottingley. Not an ordinary waterfall, ladies and gentlemen, for it's home to one of the oldest myths of mankind. We humans are not alone. We share our planet with a quite different order of life. Fairies. They're spoken of in every culture of the world, from New Zealand to the New Hebrides. Handmaidens of nature, according to some, assisting in propagation and growth. Another theory. Exiles from heaven. God's orphans straddling this world and the next, messengers between the two worlds, perhaps.
All right. Nature's handmaidens, indeed. We've been talking about fairies since the show began. Now it's time to talk to Fiona Marr, author of several books, including The Secret of the Cottingley Fairies and her latest, The Last Changeling. So Fiona Marr, I've done my best in my meager way to set up this story, but maybe you can fill in some of the gaps. Tell us what was going on in 1917 in the village of Cottingley.
Okay, good afternoon, Colin. Well, what happened was two little girls, Elsie and Frances, went to the beck, which is the local word for a stream that ran behind the house, and they took these photographs, which were developed and found to show fairies. These photographs were then allegedly passed around the family, put into a drawer and forgotten. And it wasn't until 1919 that one of the girls' mothers was at a meeting of the Theosophical Society, and she showed them to a lady speaker. And then eventually they came to the notice of this chap who just played the clip from, Edward Gardner. And Edward Gardner was so taken with them, he took them on a tour of Britain. And he was in London, and a certain lady called E.M. Blomfield saw them. And she sent them to her cousin, copies of these photographs, and that was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, he was very suspicious at first. But eventually he fell for their charm and by 1920 completely believed in them and had them published in the Strand newspaper. And that's the story as most people know it.
Right. So there's kind of an odd paradox there when we get to Conan Doyle. Conan Doyle gives us Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes is the master of the scientific method, and I'm sure a firm believer in Occam's razor. Don't believe in things that you don't have any need to believe in. Believe in what you can see and understand scientifically. We're in a completely other end of the spectrum with the Cottingley fairies. So what happened?
Absolutely, yes. Well, there are several reasons why he would believe. He actually sort of got hoist by his own petard, you know, this idea that when you remove what's the impossible, whatever is left, however improbable, must be the truth. That was a quote from Sherlock Holmes. First of all, he trained as an ophthalmologist, so he had a firm belief that people could actually, well, children could see more than adults. And that's not so far from the truth, because children certainly can hear more than adults. That's been scientifically proven now. But he believed that they could sort of pierce the veil and see through either end of the spectrum. In 1895, I believe it was, a chap called Roentgen had discovered X-rays. Now, if we had any technology now that was more than 20 years old, we would think it was quite old. But in those days, that was still quite a new breakthrough. And it must have been awfully strange to suddenly find that you could see through solid flesh. And I think there have been a lot of people around then thinking, if only we had the right technology, surely we could see fairies. So that was one strand against him. The second was, as indeed, again, perfectly illustrated in the clip you played, anyone who believed in spiritualism had this notion that fairies would somehow be the thin end of the wedge, that somehow if we could get people to believe in fairies, they would then start taking on board this whole idea of spiritualism. The next strand that kind of really helped to bolster this case was there's a lot of people doing this thing called spirit photography at the time. It was just shortly after when the pictures were allegedly taken, it was during the First World War, because that ran 1914 to 1918. But so many people had lost children in that war. They'd lost their sons. There were so many grieving families, and people were desperate to believe in something. And certain photographers would take photographs and would superimpose the pictures of the sons upon them, so they could almost see that their children were still with them. So all these things, but most compelling of all, I believe, is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's upbringing. His uncle, Dickie Doyle, illustrated many fairy books. So the young Doyle grew up with all these fairy illustrations around him. But even more than that, his father, Charles Altamont Doyle, painted lots and lots of fairies all the time. But this was while he was confined to a lunatic asylum. Now, most people of that age, Victorian Edwardian, if you had somebody who had mental illness, it was a subject of extreme shame, and it wouldn't be mentioned. But Conan Doyle so loved his father, he organised an art exhibition of his work while his father was locked away. He also had him illustrate the 1888 edition of A Study in Scarlet, and he actually used the pseudonym Altamont, his father's middle name, as a pseudonym for Sherlock Holmes in his last bow, which is the final Sherlock Holmes story. So I think Doyle thought, if I can prove fairies exist, it goes some way to validate my father's sort of strange hobby of painting fairies.
Right. You know, Fiona, in a way, we have this kind of perfect storm here. We've got, as you say, some technology that was going on that might point people at this notion that something could be photographed that couldn't have been photographed before. Then we have this spiritualist movement, which really starts, you know, really comes into flower, I think, more in the late 19th century and builds steam. So, yeah, you've got here on this side of the pond, you've got William James deeply interested in parapsychology. You've got all kinds of British intellectuals drifting towards spiritualism. Yeats was involved in theosophy, and then I think he got kicked out and got involved in some hermetic older order of the Golden Band or something. There was just a lot of magical and spiritualism accompanying the Industrial Revolution or reacting to the Industrial Revolution, and then you've got World War One.
I think the Industrial Revolution started the slide away from organized religion. But Rupert Graves, in his book Farewell to All That, said that there was no way religion could last more than a couple of days if you were in the hell of the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the bereft families, but you also had swathes of young men coming home who were so scornful of any sort of patriarchal religion by the time they came back. It was ripe for something like theosophy, which was almost, it was really akin to a New Age religion, because what theosophy did was it picked all the lovely bits out of all religions, all the bit about being nice to each other and loving one another and appreciating nature, and put all those together and threw away all the dogma and the idea of a vengeful God and the idea of an Old Testament God who was angry and, you know, and judgmental. So I can see why people would find this kind of sunnier religion light, if you like, much more appealing than anything. You know, if you've been through hell, the last thing you want to do is to go to a church and have some blood and fire preacher, you know, pointing at you and screaming at you that you're going to hell if you've already been there. So I think really everybody was absolutely right for belief in fairies. But in my book, The Secret of the Cosmic Fairies, what I suggest is it wasn't just two little girls up against the mind of the greatest sort of creator, the greatest detective. I think the whole family were in on the hoax. And that's simply because I find it very difficult to believe that these sensational pictures were just put in a drawer and forgotten for 2 years. And the one thing, if you look at it that way round, you then start looking at the pictures of the girls, because there's a second set of photographs taken in 1920, and they really do not appear to have aged significantly. The actual ages of the girls, depending on the accounts, range from 8 to 10 for the youngest and from 14 to 17 for the eldest. And, you know, either way, you know, sort of, I think the youngest was about 10, and 10 to 13 is a huge developmental leap in anyone's life. And so I had to look almost exactly the same in the photographs. I find that beggars belief, but no one seems to have come at it from that angle yet. But what I did, I started researching the whole story, and I discovered a picture in a newspaper that was published very early in 1918, in April 1918, and it showed a girl sitting by a hedge with some paper cut out fairies around her. And it made absolutely no pretense whatsoever that these were real fairies. And this newspaper magazine was very, very popular at the time. It's called The Sphere. And I believe that Arthur Wright, who was Elsie Wright's father, that was the eldest girl, I believe he saw it and thought, I can do better than this.
So, but, you know, let me, before we run out of time, I do want to say, like, to our eyes in 2017, these don't look very convincing. I mean, they...
Of course not. No, but think about it. How often do you see CGI in a movie and you think, that is really good? And then a couple of years later, you look at it and you think, oh, that's really clunky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the eye gets more and more sophisticated as you go on. In those days, you know, people would have thought they were marvelous.
Right.
Also, poor Conan Doyle never actually saw the original plates, because Gardner, with the best intention, had them, as he said, improved. But really, it was a chap called Harold Snelling who he absolutely doctored them and made them look so much better than they originally were.
Now, eventually, as older women, these two formerly younger girls, Elsie and Frances, they did recant, right?
Well, they did. What happened was a chap did called Fred Gettings. He wrote about the fairy pictures. He found the identical images in a book called The Princess Mary Gift Book, which was very prevalent in sort of it was actually published to make money for the war effort in the First War. And he noticed that each pose of a page of dancers was just like the fairies, but without wings. And Glenn, who was Elsie Wright's son, confronted her when she was an old lady and said, look, this is it, isn't it? This is what you've done. And she admitted. And the two of them had fallen out by then, the two girls, Elsie and Frances, by then old ladies. But they both admitted they'd faked the pictures. But Frances, who'd been the younger girl, said that the fifth photograph was legitimate.
That's right. That's my favorite thing. Yeah, all the other ones were hoaxes, but then fairies showed up for the actual fifth photograph.
That's what she said, but then a chap called Geoffrey Crawley, who's a photographic expert, revealed it was a double exposure sometime in the 1980s.
Fiona Maher, we're gonna have to stop here. We're running out of time. I know, so much more to say about that. And we hate to debunk fairies, but maybe these fairies need to be debunked. The movie Photographing Fairies, I don't know, it's not for everyone, but I really enjoyed it. But then, as you could tell from the beginning of the show, I grew up with fairies. I'm very pro-fairy. Thanks to Fiona Maher, all of our other guests. Thanks to Josh Nalea for humoring me, which is a big part of the job of being a producer on this show. We'll be back tomorrow.